Of the winter season is hitting Northern California and Nevada right now. Weather Channel meteorologist Jackie Jarris.
We still have the entire weekend to get through with terrible travel conditions across the Sierra and much of the West. We've got wind problems, we've got blizzard conditions, and we could see a lot of power outages.
President Biden announced the U.S. will begin airdropping food to Palestinians in dire need in Gaza. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
The biggest risk is making sure that nobody gets hurt on the ground. And so you got to locate out areas to drop. This is a war zone. So there's an added element of potential danger to the pilots and the aircraft.
The president's decision to provide more help came after hundreds of Palestinians were shot while rushing an aid convoy in Gaza. A United Nations worker was at the hospital where many were treated.
This hospital is treating more than 200 people that were injured, people with gunshot wounds. You have seen amputees, children as young as 12 that were injured. These events cannot be allowed to go on. We need to have safe, secure passage throughout Gaza to reach the people that need humanitarian aid.
CVS and Walgreens say they'll start selling the abortion pill mifepristone at stores in some states. The Supreme Court is considering if FDA approval of the pill should be reversed. University of Chicago researcher Lee Hasselbacher addressed the safety of the pill.
There's been a long history of research on the safety of mifepristone. A review of studies found, 99% of patients have no serious complications.
The director of the movie Rust, who was shot and injured on the set, testified about what happened. CBS's Omar Villafranca.
I remember initially thinking, had she been startled by it? And then I saw the blood.
Movie director Joel Souza described the pain and shock he felt moments after a bullet killed cinematographer Helena Hutchins, then lodged in his shoulder while on the set of the movie Rust. Souza told the court,
I still didn't quite know what had happened. Nothing made sense.
Hannah Gutierrez-Reed was in charge of weapons on the set, including the one held by actor and producer Alec Baldwin that killed Hutchins and injured Souza. She's been charged with involuntary manslaughter and evidence tampering.
Fashion icon Iris Apfel has died at the age of 102. She spoke about how she handled aging.
If God is good enough to give you extra years, why the devil don't you want to enjoy them? And not go and get your face carved up to try to look a few years younger.
This is CBS News.
Download the free Upside app to earn real cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code RADIO for an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first fill up. That's promo code RADIO.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Diversity efforts are curbed at Wisconsin State Universities, and Republicans promise more scrutiny of diversity, equity, and inclusion across state government in the months to come. But as Farah Siddiqui reports, states that cut back on DEI are literally paying a price.
When events are scheduled in places with policies that are considered non-inclusive or discriminatory, that place is often assumed to support these initiatives. Dr. M. Ray Perryman of the Perryman Group, who conducted the independent analysis, says some potential visitors will choose to go elsewhere rather than support places they think are less open to diversity and equity. He says this avoidance risks millions for the Missouri economy.
Travel and tourism losses in Missouri and Kansas could total hundreds of millions of dollars per year, with an associated loss in revenue to the states and local governments.
Bills now under consideration include SB 1314, which would limit state funding for diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and SB 980, which would prohibit state agencies from doing business with companies unless they'd agreed not to be part of economic boycotts. The Perryman Research says with these types of policies, the state would risk losing nearly $2.6 billion in annual income and almost 24,000 jobs by the year 2030. Perryman also points out that controversial public policies are discouraging to skilled workers seeking long-term employment and young workers as they consider where to begin their careers. He says it also plays a role for organizations in Missouri concerned about retaining employees.
At a time when the U.S. economy is facing major challenges and uncertainty, the competition for quality corporate locations and expansions, as well as skilled workers, is particularly intense, and anti-DEI measures can be particularly damaging for future prosperity.
The report warns of similar negative financial consequences for the state of Kansas. I'm Farah Siddiqui. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Hey, everybody, it's Todd Alba. Monday, noon to 2, we'll preview the Super Tuesday primary and more right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and 58. Mostly clear, lows around 40 tonight. 67 and windy for your Sunday under mostly sunny skies. Chance of a shower Sunday night, a low near 47. And a chance of showers and thunderstorms Monday with highs in the low 60s.
Currently, 42 degrees.
News talk and the sports that made Wisconsin great. Packers, Bucks, and coming in 2024, the Brewers. 1400 AM and 99.9 and 98.1 FM, WRJN.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Jim Santel, and yes, indeed, I am your host this hour and next hour as well on all the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you with me once again this morning. We're broadcasting this morning from the Civic Media Studios, a special venue right here on State Street in downtown Milwaukee, just adjacent to the wonderful UW-Madison campus here in downtown Madison. And because of that, this morning, as you want to call in, let us know about your comments, questions, inquiries about the subject matters of our day. We have a special phone number for you this morning. That's 608-610-1126. That number, once again, 608-610-1126. As always, this is our weekly review, our summary, our analysis of those major events, those news stories that are affecting our lives daily, weekly, monthly, every single year in the areas of what? Of government and law, justice, the aspiration for justice in America, and indeed worldwide. And again, delighted to have you with me, delighted to be coming into your homes, your businesses, your cars as you travel around Wisconsin and other places in this great nation of ours, soliciting once again your thoughts and comments, questions. That number once again, 608-610-1126. I am joined in these wonderful studios here in downtown Madison of Civic Media with my terrific producer, Sam. And together we're going to take your phone calls as they come along this morning. And we do indeed have an ambitious but achievable agenda for all of us this morning. And we ask inside that agenda three fundamental questions. What happened? What do we know? What about the facts of the things that are animating our lives out there? Why are those things relevant? Why are they material? Why are they substantive? And why should we care about those things? And that leads to the third question. What options do we have when it comes to deciding what we do about them? What actions can we take, should we take, may we take in response to the things that we know and the relevant things that animate our lives? All three of those questions answered to greater and lesser degrees during the course of our 2 hours this morning. Again, delighted to have you with me. So what is that syllabus that Sam and I are going to be bringing to you this hour and next hour as well, right here on broadcast stations of Civic Media? It is diverse, and there is indeed a lot, as you can well anticipate from the news of just this past week. We spend a lot of time on this Saturday morning broadcast talking about the United States Supreme Court. More and more, the Supreme Court making decisions that affect our daily lives, sometimes even by the hour, depending upon the nature, the focus of the substantive issue before the Supreme Court. This week, no difference from that. We're going to chat a lot about, of course, these three major cases that are pending before the United States Supreme Court, having to do with a presidential candidate His name is Donald Trump, of course, and we're going to chat about what happened this past week when it comes to the decision by the Supreme Court to review to grant certiorari, that, of course, the Latin term for agreeing to hear a lower court's ruling on what? On whether or not a president is immune under the Constitution, under the laws of our country, for the actions that he, maybe one day she, does when it comes to official activities, unofficial activities. Is a president completely immune from criminal prosecution for the things that he or she may do? Fascinating, but easy question to answer. However, the procedure of this, not at all easy. We're going to talk about what the Supreme Court decided to do just this past week that is going to have a dramatic impact as well upon the other major issues of this year. Yet that indeed is the presidential election and other elections around the country. There are two other cases, as you know, pending before the United States Supreme Court. That involves Colorado and this decision about whether or not Donald Trump's name will appear on the primary ballot in that state. Frankly, others as well. We're going to talk about the implications of that presumably forthcoming decision. We know that this coming Tuesday is Super Tuesday. 16 different states out there conducting primary elections this coming Tuesday, including Colorado. I'm going to chat with you about the Colorado schedule and why it is important that the Supreme Court, of all these three, decide this one as expeditiously as possible. Management would also be a good thing with respect to the immunity case as well. And the third case, too, which involves this fellow named Fisher. And the action there, the issue there, the focus there, of course, is on whether or not the statute, the particular federal criminal statute under which Mr. Fisher was charged and convicted for his involvement in the January 6th riot, whether that statute is valid when it comes to application to these kinds of actions. Why is that significant? Why is that related to Donald Trump? And it is because that same statute is one of those that's charged in the four counts against Donald Trump in the federal case in Washington, D.C. We're going to chat about those three cases, especially focusing upon the implications of what that immunity decision was this past week. That is to take the case, to hear it, to entertain oral argument, and presumably to issue an order sometime in the next, not just weeks, probably months, and the timing implications for that on 2024. As we've said a lot on this Saturday morning broadcast, one of the major themes is not only the law and the aspiration for justice, government, the intersection of all of those things, but also in this year, especially the intersection between all of those things and politics and government and electing officials, including the president of the United States of America. The overriding theme, of course, TikTok. Time. How quickly can these things be done? What is the intersection of scheduling by the judges presiding over the other cases that we'll also touch upon today and these decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, presumably sometime in the next several months? We're also going to spend some time this week talking about two other matters that do have some connection to the campaign itself, but they're not directly related to Donald Trump or the other things that are pending right now in those four criminal cases against him. We're going to spend some time talking about a major oral argument having to do with the interaction between social media platforms and the government. States attempting to tell social media platforms what they can and cannot do, whether there is a First Amendment implication when those social media platforms like X and Facebook and others are out there making decisions for the purposes of getting rid of those platforms of misinformation, incendiary things, things that are simply inaccurate, misleading, whether states can regulate those platforms and making those all-important decisions with respect to content. Can states, and two in particular, can they provide prohibitions to those social media providers that are constitutional? Just this past week, the United States Supreme Court entertained oral argument on that major question. What is the connection between state governments, state legislatures, and these private providers, these platform providers that plainly are inside our lives and affecting our lives in a major way? Second, there was also a major Supreme Court oral argument this past week having to do with guns. We've talked a lot about that on our Saturday morning broadcast as well. This major focus that the Supreme Court has in this term, once again, on firearms, 3, 4, 5 cases pending before the Supreme Court. And this past week, the Supreme Court took up the issue of bump stocks, bump stocks and whether or not the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, this federal agency responsible for oversight, administering the state laws and the federal laws and the administrative decisions out there, all those kinds of things, ATF has made the decision that bump stocks are illegal and that they cannot be properly sold, possessed, used, and those kinds of things. A challenge to that decision, whether or not bump stocks are indeed accessible and should be accessible to people. We'll chat about what bump stocks do, what the history of them is. We all remember well that major event in October of 2017 in Las Vegas that prompted all of us to take another look at this issue of bump stocks. All of that coming up in our Saturday morning broadcast. We're going to go then to some other updates in the law. We're going to chat about what's going on in Florida, some major issues and non-major issues decided yesterday by Judge Eileen Cannon in the Federal District Court there. That, of course, the case pending against Donald Trump and other defendants involving his taking, his use, his management, his mismanagement, his misuse, allegedly, of documents that are only classified, but documents that he should not have. Allegations, criminal allegations, again, under federal law. A hearing just yesterday in front of the federal district court judge, anticipating that she was going to set a trial date. We'll determine whether or not she did that yesterday and other things that she's got in her docket right now that are likewise going to impact what happens in that case down the road. We had a major decision, major event in the Teixeira case. You may recall this is the young man who was responsible for violating and influencing and releasing a huge amount of information from his role inside the military, charged recently with violations of the federal law having to do with the proper non-disclosure of information. And it appears that Monday, he is going to plead guilty. We don't know exactly what that's going to be. We're going to talk about the Teixeira case and bring you up to date on that as well. And then going back to the Supreme Court again, we know that there was some recent history with respect to the drug of mifepristone, a case pending, going to be heard by the Supreme Court oral argument on March 26th, an event just this past week by CVS and Walgreens that has an impact upon mifepristone, its accessibility, even as the Supreme Court is reviewing a decision of the lower court there with respect to access to that drug. Of course, that's one of the two major drugs that is used in providing reproductive services and abortion services in particular for 20 or more years. The FDA having been given the authorization, the okay, to go ahead and use that drug safely and securely, that now challenged by the lower courts and the Supreme Court determining whether or not access to the drug should continue. That coming up also in our discussion this morning. Finally, at the end of our second hour, we're going to go back, as promised over the period of the past couple of broadcasts, and talk about some international cases, something coming out of Mexico, a significant electoral issue coming up in this coming year and early next year as well. We're going to talk about some things happening in Brazil and in Pakistan, even in Germany, especially in Brazil and Pakistan, some reverberations, some echoes of things here in the United States of America, some leaders, some past leaders, some allegations of corruption and involvement of the military, believe it or not, with respect to one of those venues in administering the rule of law. A lot on our Saturday morning agenda here today. All of that coming up. We invite you, as always, to be a part of our discussion. Again, that number, that special number coming to us from our studios in Madison, 608-610-1126. Sam and I will take your phone calls and we'll be engaged and responsive to your comments, your questions, especially your inquiries about what's going on in all of these areas. Right after this break, we'll begin that all-important discussion. Stay with us for that right after this.
You're listening to WRJN, Southeastern Wisconsin's home for Matt Nair on Air.
This is Don Rosen. You know, it's great to be welcomed back to WRJN to super serve the folks in the Racine and surrounding areas every morning, 6 to 8 on 1400 AM, 99.9 FM, and 98.1 FM. WRJN, hometown radio refreshed.
Hi, I'm Pete Schwabe, an actor, writer, director, and comedian.
Join me for my new show, Nightlight, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll chill after a long day in traffic, talking politics, or trying to look busy at work. We'll talk movies, TV, theater, music, and lots of fun Wisconsin stuff. So mix an old-fashioned and join the discussion. We'll go from Wisconsin to Hollywood and back, and you can still be in bed at a reasonable hour. It's Nightlight with Pete Schwabba from 7 to 9 p.m. on 1400 AM, 99.9 and 98.1 FM, WRJN.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
This is News Talk and Sports for Racine and Kenosha, WRJN.
We are back. Thank you once again for joining me and my terrific producer here in the studios of Civic Media in downtown Washington, downtown Madison. We're going to get to Washington, D.C. Sam and I are here to take your phone calls. That number, once again, 608-610-1126. Thank you for joining me for this discussion. Let's get right to it. Let's talk about this big news coming out of the United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., but affecting us here in Madison, in Milwaukee, and all other cities and states around the country. Here in our great nation. Just this past week, the Supreme Court made a major decision about how it's going to be handling this challenge by Donald Trump to lower court rulings finding that he is not immune. He is not presidentially immune from the conduct in which he engaged when he was the president of the United States of America. We know, as a part of the underlying criminal prosecution, four counts brought by the Department of Justice and Jack Smith alleging election interference. And all four of those, again, pending before Tanya Chutkan, who is the district court judge there in Washington, D.C., presiding over the trial. She had scheduled a trial to begin fairly soon. She took that off her calendar because this issue about whether or not Donald Trump is immune from prosecution in that case and arguably others pending before her. She resolved this a long time ago. She issued a compelling order. I commend your reading of it, in which she said, you know what? Presidents are not kings, and we have not done that for 240 years. We do not have that in our system. No one is above the law. That decision goes up to the D.C. Court of Appeals. Again, they spent some time chewing on all that, ultimately, after about a month or so, issued an equally compelling order to the same event, the same end in that case as well, finding that there's no presidential immunity. This is a frivolous argument. They didn't use that word, but I will. There is no doubt that there will not be presidential immunity in the United States of America, as long as we are a nation that does observe the rule of law for everyone, including our chief executive. It is that decision from the D.C. Court of Appeals that Donald Trump sought review of before the United States Supreme Court. And so a couple of weeks ago, he filed a petition for what's called a writ of certiorari. A writ of certiorari, basically a mechanism by which a petitioner asks the highest court in the land to take a look at my case. We know as of this morning, the Supreme Court has granted those writs in about 61 cases. And indeed, as of just this past week, one of those 61 is the case coming out of the D.C. Court of Appeals, now before the United States Supreme Court. They're going to review this. So let's think about what that means, what the implications of that are. The Supreme Court, plainly, as we know, played with this issue a little bit previously. You may recall well that at the time that Tanya Chutkan issued her order and Donald Trump sought appeal before the appeals court, Jack Smith sought the Supreme Court's review right away. So let's hopscotch over the Court of Appeals. Supreme Court, take this on right away. Let's get this moving. Let's keep it moving so we can remain on the trial calendar of Tanya Chutkan. The Supreme Court at that time said, nope. We're going to let this go through the regular process, and indeed it did, the process I just described, that resulted ultimately in a further delay, if you will, in articulating this fundamental notion that, yes, indeed, the sun rises in the east. This is not a difficult issue. All the courts finding that there is no such thing as presidential immunity. And that led an awful lot of people to think, you know what? probably not the case that the Supreme Court is going to entertain this further. There is nothing to decide here. You don't have a split in the circuits you've got to resolve. You don't have a situation where you've got a major kind of issue out there that needs resolution at a national, a federal level. This is not it. This has been settled law for a very, very long period of time. And so when Donald Trump sought this writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court, the speculation was, hopefully, that the Supreme Court would say, you know what, the lower courts have done this just right, and they've got the focus on this, and they got it just right in terms of the disposition of it. Supreme Court took about 2 weeks or so, and again, the speculation was the conventional wisdom, turned out to be neither conventional nor wisdom, was that the Supreme Court was going to deny certiorari, going to say, no, there's nothing to look at here. This is a near frivolous argument. And the reason for the delay is we had all the members of the Supreme Court, all nine of them, perhaps writing dissents, concurrences, all kinds of things, weighing in on the issue about whether or not they should take it at all. But ultimately, the Supreme Court saying, this is what the speculation was, that we were not going to take this at all and leave the law of the case at the Court of Appeals, which is, once again, that there is no immunity for a sitting president. Goes back then to the district court judge, Tanya Chutkan, and she can schedule this, get this back on her calendar. That did not happen. And that's the big news of this past week. Just this past week, the Supreme Court issues a very brief order and says, you know what, we're going to grant that petition. Significantly does some things with respect to timing. Says, you know what, we are going to require briefs, and sets forth a briefing schedule for that, and sets April 22nd, yes, that's right, April 22nd, near the end of the next month, for oral argument on that case, which means that this decision by the Supreme Court, this decision where presumably all the justices will now weigh in, as did the lower court, the trial court, the appeals court, all those justices will now weigh in on this fundamental question to which we all know the answer. And that is that presidents are not, in fact, immune from criminal prosecution. Nonetheless, probably because they're interested in their place in history, maybe, we don't know for sure, maybe John Roberts, the Chief Justice, wanted to have a say in this. Maybe a majority of the Supreme Court members also wanted to have a say in this, and each wanted to be able to say, for the purposes of history, for generations to come, that this is what we believe. This is what the Constitution says. This is what the Federalist Papers say. This is what our founding fathers say. This is the premise upon which our entire nation depends, which is we do not have a monarchy. We got rid of that. 240 years ago. We're not going back. And the reason why this is such a clear issue is because if they were to go in the opposite direction, it quite literally opens up the possibility of the restoration of a monarchy, a chief executive that is completely contrary to what's in the Constitution. The whole idea behind the establishment of the presidency, Article 2 of the Constitution, first time in human history, this concept set forth in a constitutional document. The notion was there are checks and balances, there are limits on all of this. And the Supreme Court basically saying this week, we're going to hopefully they will reaffirm that fundamental decision, but it's not going to come out until June. We're not going to decision until June of this year, along with the other 60 or so cases also pending, also writs of certiorari granted. And what that means is if the Supreme Court issues an opinion, presumably affirming this basic notion that we already know, it's going to be impossible for Tanya Chutkan to get this scheduled right on her calendar. It will not be the case if the Supreme Court decides this case on, say, June 10th, that on June 11th, 12th, or 13th, she can begin jury selection. She's already established some buffer periods in there, about 80-some days, for the parties, including Donald Trump as the defendant in this case, to have some time to file more motions, to prepare for trial. That gets us well into the summer and even into the fall, becomes increasingly unlikely that this case can be tried before the election in November. We don't know for sure. She's going to need to find at least a couple of months, maybe even more, in her docket, which is not an easy thing for a district court judge to do, before this case gets back on the calendar for a trial, assuming, once again, the Supreme Court does the right thing, affirms this fundamental notion that there is not indeed a notion of presidential immunity. All of this plainly affecting the election, including the conventions coming up, and plainly, the campaign going forward, bringing us up to the November election. When we come back, we're going to talk more about other Supreme Court cases, the impact of those, and once again, the major theme of this year, which is timing. Stay with us for that discussion. Yeah.
Sunday. Yeah! And home of the Packers. 1400 AM and 99.9 and 98.1 FM, WRJN.
CBS News Brief. A big blizzard is dumping foot after foot of snow in the mountains of Northern California and Nevada. This man who lives in Pollock Pines, California, is ready for potential problems.
I do expect with the high winds that the power will go out this weekend. It might not, but we're ready if it does.
President Biden announced the U.S. will launch airdrops of food in Gaza, but he says much more help is needed.
Aid flowing to Gaza is nowhere nearly enough. Now it's nowhere nearly enough.
Fashion icon Iris Apfel has died. She spoke about how she handled aging.
If God is good enough to give you extra years, why the devil don't you want to enjoy them and not go and get your face carved up to try to look a few years younger?
She had millions of followers on social media where she showed off her bold sense of style. She was 102 years old. CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and 58. Mostly clear, lows around 40 tonight. 67 and windy for your Sunday under mostly sunny skies. Chance of a shower Sunday night, a low near 47. And a chance of showers and thunderstorms Monday with highs in the low 60s.
Right now, it's 44.
Hello. Hey, can I have your attention for just a moment? If you're in Racine County, I'm talking to you. You know, we have elections in August and November. That's when we can decide to vote to keep lawmakers on the job or throw them out and try someone new. This recall business with Robin Voss, it's just plain dumb. It's a giant waste of more than $400,000 in taxpayer money. And we just have to turn around and have the regular elections in November anyway. Whatever you think of Robin Voss, just say no to the stupid recall. Don't sign a petition because you're sick of politics as usual. The stupid recall won't accomplish anything other than wasting taxpayer dollars. It's bad enough when politicians do that to us. We shouldn't do it to ourselves. Okay? All right, I'll let you get back to whatever you were doing. Paid for by Wisconsinites for Liberty Fund, not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Civic Media's Rich LoCascio. Could you introduce me as a wrestler right now? You could call me like the Punching Bag or the Patsy or something.
From Green Bay, Wisconsin, the Punching Bag, Pete Schwabba.
Now I'd be looking across the ring at my opponent's eyes getting really wide as he got ready to wail on me.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
When you think about it, talk radio is its own type of sport. News Talk and Sports, 1400 AM and 99.9 and 98.1 FM, WRJN.
We are back here in our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you once again for joining me as we talk about all things Supreme Court. This major news about the decision of the United States Supreme Court to entertain, to take on Donald Trump's position. That is his belief, his contention, his argument before lower courts and now the Supreme Court that he is immune or was immune from any criminal prosecution, any acts he conducted while he was the president of the United States of America. The Supreme Court now taking that decision of the lower courts on and presumably going to issue their own opinion. Guess from an awful lot of people who are much brighter than I am that they're probably going to issue a number of different opinions depending upon how they get there. It would be a good thing for America. It would be a very good thing for America if this particular opinion, even if justices issue their own concurring or agreeing opinions, if this is a 9-0 decision. A definitive, dispositive, very clear statement by the Supreme Court that no, indeed, a president does not have immunity for the things that he or one day she does while in office. That's an important decision not only to render, but also to state clearly for the American public, for this generation and for generations to come. We'll see what they do. Again, highly unlikely now that that decision will come out anytime before June, when the Supreme Court, as you know well, issues a great number of its opinions, lots of things that we have talked about already, but lots of things we're going to talk about this morning and beyond. A decision coming out in June on that issue, as you know, in July, right here in Wisconsin, the Republican National Convention in Chicago, right down the street from us, in August. The Democrats are meeting, and then the election anticipated for November. Lots of things going on. Almost impossible for Aline Chutkan, Tanya Chutkan, to identify a significant period of time between June and Labor Day, or even beyond that, to find a significant period of time. Easily 8, maybe 10 weeks of trial time needed to try this case. Or if she does, and yes, indeed, there's a remote possibility that could be placed on her calendar, it's going to bump right up to the election in November, and certainly the campaigning that's going on during the course of the late summer and then also into the fall. A fascinating procedural issue here that may, in fact, give Donald Trump the remedial relief that he is seeking. If indeed, this case goes to trial sometime after he is elected or reelected president of the United States of America, if indeed that happens in American history, lots and lots of ifs, speculation here this morning, as always. But again, the consistent theme, timing. All of this about timing as we think about the involvement of the Supreme Court. Supreme Court also has, of course, at least two other matters that are also intersecting with our campaign, our presidential campaign of this year. One of them, of course, coming out of Colorado. We know that well. We've talked about that a lot. This decision by the Colorado Supreme Court to remove Donald Trump's name from the primary ballot there. And that petition, the request for a writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court, also granted. Supreme Court, having heard oral argument a few weeks back, very, very skeptical of this notion that a state can prevent Donald Trump from being on the ballot there, that that's perhaps an overreach even by a state high court. So likely that the Supreme Court will at some point, hopefully soon, because that too is important to get resolved quickly, probably is going to tell the Colorado folks that they've got to put his name back on the ballot. Why is that all significant? Again, timing, tick-tock, this continuing issue. Well, we know that this coming Tuesday is, yes, that's right, Super Tuesday, 16 states holding elections of various sorts, including Colorado, the presidential preference primary there on March 5th. They've got a June 25th primary coming up. Presumably, long before then, the Supreme Court will tell the Colorado folks whether they can or cannot remove Donald Trump from the primary ballot there as that matter goes forward. But again, an important focus on timing as the Supreme Court issues that decision. That's the second case that is also pending. Also fairly clear in its disposition. The third case, as we've talked about a lot, also some significant movement just this past week, this Fisher case. And the Fisher case, again, based upon a prosecution of this gentleman named Fisher, who is among the more than 1,000 people, who have been investigated and charged and convicted, sentenced for their involvement in the riot at the Capitol on January 6th. He's alleging that the statute under which the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecuted him is not applicable to the facts of his case. And the Supreme Court decided to grant cert on that a while ago. I've reported repeatedly on this Saturday morning broadcast the curious notion that the Supreme Court has not to date scheduled that matter for oral argument. Well, they changed that. They changed that again just this past week or so. And indeed, on April 16th of this year, a week or so before the Supreme Court entertains the immunity argument, a week before that, they're going to entertain the argument from Mr. Fisher about what this statute means, whether it applies there. And yes, indeed, depending upon what they decide, whether they agree with Mr. Fisher or not, or maybe come down somewhere in the middle, depending upon what they say to us about this particular federal criminal statute, it could have a dramatic impact once again upon the federal criminal prosecution pending down the street in front of Tanya Chutkan. All these things much interrelated. That case, again, not going to be resolved anytime before June, especially since now it's got an April 16th oral argument date, anticipating June being an important month, not only for these cases, but for many others out there. That is the update, if you will, on those three major cases pending before the United States Supreme Court, having to do with the prosecutions, the interplay between those Supreme Court cases and jurisprudence and what's going on in the political arena today. We're going to get back to another case that's also scheduled for oral argument on March 26 in connection with Mifepristone. I'm going to get back to that in just a few moments or so. But before we do, before we depart and go back to other cases around the nation, I also want to chat about two other significant oral arguments of just this past week, not having to do with immunity, not having to do with Colorado, not having to do with this Fisher argument, the argument about the federal criminal statute. This one has to do principally with social media and the interplay between government and in particular state legislatures and social media platform providers. We know that the cases themselves are called Moody versus NetChoice and NetChoice versus Paxton. Big contests about the power of social media companies, what they can and cannot do, having to do with placements of posts on their platforms. If the Supreme Court reviews these cases in a way that says that the Florida and Texas laws, which I'll describe here in just a moment once again, are in fact constitutional going ahead, changes dramatically the way in which governments interplay and have an intersection with private social media providers. A lot of argument about that just this past week. So the Texas law, as we have said before on this broadcast, what does it do? It prohibits social media platforms from taking down content, from removing content based upon what they describe as the viewpoint of the user or expressed in the post. That's what the law says. You can't do that. You can't do that if you're Google, if you're X, other social media platforms. The law actually gives individuals, this is the state law, the Texas law, also gives individuals who find themselves removed from those social media platforms, gives those individuals and also the attorney general the right to file lawsuits against those platforms for violations of the state law. It's pretty dramatic. And that comes out of Texas. There's a Florida law also, not quite as dramatic, but pretty darn close. That Florida law fines platforms if they permanently bar from their sites a candidate for office in the state. In other words, if you remove anything from an active candidate for office in the state of Florida, you can be subject to fines in that state. It also forbids the platforms from taking down content from a journalistic enterprise. That's what they describe it, a journalistic enterprise, and requires the companies to be upfront about their rules for moderating content, basically explaining to the folks whose materials are taken down why it is they're being taken down in every single instance. A huge burden this would pose, plainly, in Florida upon the social media providers to justify the reasons for their taking it down. Now, as we've discussed before, lots of reasons for these particular decisions by the social media providers to address things that are in the nature of misinformation. We know that there's an awful lot out there that was posted about potential completely unfounded cures for COVID-19, regarded not only by the administration, but also by medical authorities around the nation as being dangerous. People reading these things on social media platforms, perhaps following them to their own demise, their own detriment. Hugely significant. Also things that are contrary to our basic understandings about how we interact with each other. Things that are sexist and racist and misogynist and homophobic. And all those other immutable characteristics that we celebrate, attacks on those immutable characteristics, the people who hold them, all those kinds of things that folks like Facebook, YouTube, X, all those kind of social media platforms address, take them down, not just as being offenses, but being contrary to the fundamental ways in which we communicate. Those kinds of things, once again, within the purview, is the strong and compelling argument, of a private platform provider to take down. And one of the major things that was discussed this past week before the Supreme Court was just this notion that when it comes to the First Amendment, these particular platform providers are private. And yes, indeed, I can make the decision to post things on YouTube and Facebook and X, other social media platforms as well. But I'm doing that based upon a private contract, if you will, between me and that social media provider. These are not government entities. And the arguments, of course, were all about what the First Amendment says and does not say about these laws that direct the social media providers to justify what they're doing, to prohibit them from taking down some forms of misinformation, miscommunication, things that are contrary to the fundamental ways in which we communicate with each other. Do they, as the private providers, have that right to do it? Under the First Amendment, an awful lot of people arguing that indeed they do. And so just this past week, some of the takeaways from the Supreme Court argument about this appears that the Supreme Court very wary of these state laws regulating these social media platforms. And of course, this taking place over the course of about 4 hours of arguments this past week, a lot of focus upon the differences between the two state laws and what should happen if they go into effect. What should happen in the meantime? A majority of the courts seem to be inclined to keep those statutes on hold even while the litigation moves forward. The justices taking up this issue about whether the states are violating the First Amendment by telling these platform providers that they could not moderate the users' posts, and drawing some distinctions between government censorship, which again is a part of the First Amendment, prohibited by the First Amendment, and actions by private companies to determine what kinds of speech to include on their sites. Sonia Sotomayor says notably, she says, "I have a problem with laws that are so broad that they stifle speech just on their face." Interestingly, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, also read a sentence from a 1976 campaign finance decision that he often quotes out there. He said this: "The concept that government may restrict the speech of some elements of our society in order to enhance the relative voice of others is wholly foreign to the First Amendment." He was indicating that he was probably rejecting the state's arguments here that they can regulate the fairness of public debates in private settings. That coming from Brett Kavanaugh. Lo and behold, here again, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, saying, "I wonder, since we're talking about the First Amendment, whether our first concern should be with the state regulating what we have called the modern public square." Again, the Chief Justice also very skeptical, very wary of these state court laws. Elena Kagan said the major platforms had good reasons to reject posts, including those that incite insurrection, endanger public health, spreading hate speech, all those kinds of things. She said, "Why isn't that a First Amendment judgment?" she asked. Of course, the three more conservative members of the court, Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito and Neil Gorsuch, seemed somewhat sympathetic to the state laws. All three said phrases like content moderation, which is the catchword, the catchphrase, if you will, for what the platforms are doing. They were just euphemisms they were saying for censorship. And so you get a split court here, but probably a majority of them saying that these particular state laws cannot stand. And we will see. Justice Kavanaugh, again, embracing a position that suggests that the First Amendment cannot be abused in such a way to tell these platform providers what they can and cannot do. Well, again, this case, the other cases coming out in June, will decide exactly what happens with these social media platforms and state legislatures in these areas attempting to regulate, to moderate content on them. When we come back, we're going to talk more about another Supreme Court case also argued before the High Court just this past week.
You're
listening to WRJN, Racine and Kenosha's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
Say it with me, the Boxing Six. And you could catch every play, every score, every Milwaukee Bucks game on WRJN 1400 AM 99.9 FM in Racine, your station for the Milwaukee Bucks, your hometown radio refreshed.
Labor shortages, retention problems, it's been a challenging time for my business. But in Wisconsin, there's 600,000 people with disabilities who are ready to work right now. They just need you to believe in them and say yes. I did.
And once you say yes, ThinkAbility Wisconsin will be there, providing transition and workforce support for people with disabilities and their employers to help shape a better future for all. It all starts when you say yes. Join the movement at thinkabilitywi.org.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
You're listening to WRJN Racine, Southeastern Wisconsin's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
We're back in this, our first hour of our Saturday morning broadcast, talking all things Supreme Court. Right before this past break, talking about this major couple of social media cases pending before the Supreme Court. Likely, if you read the tea leaves somewhat, perhaps not a majority, but maybe a 6-3 opinion coming out in June saying the states that attempt to regulate, to prevent social media providers from moderating their content, which again is the phrase that's being used here, that those laws that the legislatures have passed there in Florida and Texas, those cannot stand. It appears that a majority of the Supreme Court, including justices on both sides of the political aisle, not in favor of those state court laws. We'll see what the Supreme Court says in June, but appears once again those laws will be stricken down. And again, an affirmation for the First Amendment, an affirmation certainly for the liberality, if you will, of the platform providers to engage in this First Amendment exercise, not affected, not involving intrusion by state legislatures telling them what they can and cannot post, can and cannot bring down, if indeed, again, it's contrary to our basic understandings of public safety and security and other things in the nature of hate speech, other things that are all equally inappropriate for those kinds of public platforms. We'll see what the Supreme Court does coming up in June. We will also be anticipating lots of cases coming out of the Supreme Court, as we've chatted before, about firearms in America. This term, no different from prior terms, including the decisions of recent times in Heller and Bruin, in which the Supreme Court, for the first time in hundreds of years, affirming your right to possess and own under the Second Amendment of the Constitution a handgun for self-defense, not just in your home, but also on the streets of America. That's Bruin coming out of New York just in a recent term. And again, this past term, many, many cases having to do with the extent to which the Second Amendment should prohibit certain kinds of weapons and even certain kinds of people. We talked at great length about this case, Rahimi, this gentleman who has a domestic violence restraining order imposed upon him by the state, and he is convicted by the federal authorities for possessing a weapon under federal law when he has this restraining order in place, federal law prohibiting individuals in America from possessing weapons when, in fact, there's a state restraining order imposed upon them. Mr. Rahimi challenges that, and the Supreme Court could tell us in June whether or not that federal law can stand. And again, as we talked before, Mr. Rahimi, not the best case to present this. He himself, an individual of incredible violence, and plainly, if the Supreme Court goes in that direction, even under Bruin, it has a lot of explaining to do when it comes to reconciling our fundamental notions about safety and security. The difference between ensuring that there is some understanding of rights to possess weapons, but also that there should indeed be restrictions on the kinds, places, the people who can possess weapons, given their own characteristics. Mr. Rahimi, a violent person by any measure. Speaking of violence, the other case in front of the Supreme Court just this past week has to do with the single deadliest mass shooting in our American life by one gunman. It happened in October of 2017. You recall this horrific incident. Well, a gunman stationed on the 32nd floor of a hotel in Las Vegas. opened fires at a country music festival, 2017, and he kills 61 people. He wounds 413. He's got about 1,000 rounds of ammunition up there. And one of the things that becomes clear as the investigation goes forward, even though there's never been clearly a motive for what he did on that day, what becomes clear is that he used a thing called a bump stock that basically turns a semi-automatic weapon into a machine gun. And that's the way in which he was able to engage in the absolutely horrific event back in October of 2017. The Trump administration, in the wake of that, does impose regulations that basically say that bump stocks turn weapons into machine guns. Machine guns are not permitted. They are in violation in America, can be prohibited by the ATF. And the question is whether or not the bump stocks, by virtue of their own entity, should also be regulated. The ATF, of course, and many thoughtful people concerned about the future of our safety, the future of America, say, of course, they need to be regulated. They turn weapons into machine guns. What are machine guns used for? As you know, I spent a couple of years in Iraq watching not the war up front, but seeing our young soldiers, both women and men, using these weapons of war, machine guns among them, AR-15s, those kinds of things. They're intended as weapons of war, not domestic weapons at all. They're not the kinds of things that the Supreme Court said are accessible to us, should be accessible to us in America under Bruin and Heller, even though those challenges to semi-automatic weapons and rifles continue to this day. So the question is whether or not these bump stocks should be legal in America. The challenge was brought by a fellow named Michael Cargill. He's a gun shop owner in Texas who sold these bump stocks. He's represented by a group called the New Civil Liberties Alliance. It's an advocacy group with financial ties to Charles Cook, of course, as you know, as a billionaire, has long supported some of these kinds of causes. And this group targets principally what it regards as unlawful uses of administrative power. We have talked a lot on this broadcast also about this present set of challenges, in addition to the guns challenges, all these cases that are challenging the authority of our administrative agencies to act based upon their expertise, their experience, the authority given to them by the United States Congress. This is one of those cases that brings together both guns and Second Amendment issues and also these attacks upon our administrative agencies, in this case, ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, to administer, to oversee the kinds of weapons that should be out there. Again, machine guns are illegal in America. You cannot possess them. You will be federally prosecuted. The question is whether or not by possessing and using a bump stock that turns a weapon that may in fact be legal into something that would be illegal, does the bump stock itself, can that be regulated? ATF says yes. Mr. Cargill says no. And others likewise say the same sort of thing. And here, once again, Supreme Court appears split on the ban on bump stocks that was enacted under Donald Trump. We've got a little bit of the reporting on this particular oral argument. Justice Amy Coney Barrett says, look, intuitively, I'm entirely sympathetic to your argument. She's talking to the lawyer representing the government. His name is Brian Fletcher. She said, I mean, this is functioning like a machine gun. Would she also wondered aloud why Congress had not enacted legislation that more explicitly covered these devices? Neil Gorsuch appeared to agree. He said that while the court could certainly understand why these items should be made illegal, he failed to see why an administrative agency or the Congress should be the one to act. And we also have Chief Justice John Roberts, who's often near the court's center on these kinds of things, potentially a critical vote in this, giving not so much insight into his particular position on this case. The three liberal justices, of course, seemed unified in their support for the government's decision to ban the device, repeatedly raising hypotheticals about the bump stock and how it enabled semi-automatic weapons to fire a torrent of bullets. When we come back, we're going to talk more about cases in America and chat with you further about the administration of justice, the rule of law, and government, the way that it interfaces with our lives. Stay with us in that second upcoming hour.
And sports.
Talk about your triple play.
Get this guy a jockstrap and a cookie.
1400 AM and 99.9 and 98.1 FM WRJN.
Hi, this is Dr. Tim Slecker.
And this is Dr. Johnny Lupinacci.
Friday, best of the week, trending education news.
Busted pencils every weekday at 7 p.m.
Hi, this is Don Rosen. It's great to be welcomed back to WRJN to super serve the folks in Racine and in the surrounding communities every morning. We're talking with local guests who have lifestyle and important information to share with you. We'll have local news, weather, sports, and some good morning fun as well. So wake up with me weekday morning 6 to 8 on 1400 AM and 99.9 FM in Racine and 98.1 FM in Kenosha. WRJN, hometown radio, refreshed.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on 99.9 and 98.1 FM and 1400 AM WRJN. And on the Civic Media app.
Your home for the Packers.
1400 AM WRJN Racine. 99.9 FM W260 CV Racine. And 98.1 FM W251 BU Kenosha.